Historians tell us when you look back, it does not appear that ancient Middle Eastern or African or Asian Christians decorated trees for Christmas. It just wasn't part of that tradition in that part of the world. But by the 16th century in Germany, the tradition had taken root. Decorating evergreen trees during the Christmas season was common. Of course, the decorations were homemade. The lights on the trees were actual candles. So just remember that this season, if you're, you know, stringing up your lights and none of them work, or you pull it out and it's one big tangled ball that you can't unravel, hey, at least you don't have to try to balance actual fire in the tree and light all the candles every time your kids want to see the lights. There is this older tree tradition that comes to us from the prophet Isaiah, all the way from the 8th century BCE, many years ago. Isaiah imagines a tree at the center of Israel's life, with roots reaching deep and with bright green shoots of hope emerging from the stump. And for Isaiah, this tree image blooms into this wonderful vision of a world at peace where children are never harmed and where all conflict comes to an end. It is this image of the tree of Jesse that will anchor and will guide our worship together during this Advent season. Now, if you want to cut down a tree, it's not all that difficult. You just need a chainsaw, or if you're old school, you need an axe, right? But if you want to pull up a tree by its roots, then you are up against a struggle, my friend. Stephanie and I once decided that we would like a slightly different look in our front flower beds. So we decided to remove the crepe myrtle from the corner of the flower bed and replace it with something else. I mean, how difficult could this be, right? So we started out with a shovel. After hours of jumping up and down on the shovel to try to cut through the roots, we had not even bothered this stupid thing. Then we got serious. We borrowed a truck and we tied a chain around it to try to pull it out. But it still didn't want to go. I had forgotten about this battle with our crepe myrtle until I came across this little poem entitled How to Uproot a Tree. So it's there to the insert if you want to read it. It's wonderful. You can take it home with you this week to remember the Jesse tree and how deep roots go. So how to uproot a tree, it starts with a wonderful line, stupidity helps. Naivete, that your hands will undo what does perfectly without you. My husband and I made the decision not to stop until the task was done. The small, anemic tree made room for something prettier. We'd pulled before pale hand over wide hand, a marriage of pulling toward us what we wanted, pushing away what we didn't. We had a shovel, which was mostly for show. It was mostly our fingers tunneling the dirt toward a tangle of false beginnings. The roots were branched and bearded. Some had spurs, and one of them was wholly reptilian. They had been where we had not and held a knit gravity that was not in their will to let go. We bent the trunk to the ground and sat on it, twisted from all angles. How like ropes it was, the sickly thing asserting its will, only now at the end, blind, but beyond the idea of leaving the earth. Maybe you've done what we tried to do and tear out a crepe myrtle. It's not as easy as it looks. This is a good poem. Even the spindliest, most anemic little tree will knit its way down deep into the earth, and you would never know just from a casual glance at what's above the surface how deeply this tangle of roots dives down into the earth. How branched and bearded, how spurred and reptilian these roots can be. But of course, you know by now that I'm not talking about trees or crepe myrtles. I'm talking about you and about me and about whether it's wise or even possible to hope and dream for a world of peace, a world where people get along and animals get along and where no one gets harmed. If we open ourselves to this wonderful image from Isaiah of our own lives as a deep-rooted tree with fresh little green shoots just emerging, we might be surprised how interesting, how exciting even this season of Advent might become for us. We may well need a new symbol in our time to keep hope alive because hope has had a hard year. I turned on the news while we were eating dinner last week, and Oliver politely asked in his own way if we could watch something else. "I don't like watching the news," he said. "It's all so negative." I guess it's possible to face the future with some measure of hope, but even that is a tricky enterprise. Often our hope for the future is fickle, tied to some specific uptick in circumstances, and it's great when things go well. Hey, the stock market's up. I got a promotion this week. I've got a trip scheduled. I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be great. But those circumstantial things are a very flimsy kind of hope. Other times when we find a little bit of hope in ourselves for the future, the hope turns out to be too narrow and leaves out too many other people. What might look good for me turns out not to be all that good for others. New technology, robotics, software, innovation, global trade, all this change has some real upside, but it leaves many people and many places behind. The developing world is rapidly becoming more industrialized, which is great for several things, for the alleviation of poverty, of starvation, and for infant mortality rates. But all these emissions and pollutants added to the atmosphere are bad for the earth that we share together. Truth be told, many of us who are sitting here this morning at the beginning of a new Advent season have grown so tired of hoping for anything that basically we've shut down. We've been around the block. We've seen how things work. We've watched as the rich get richer. We know the system is rigged. We know that the politicians and the corporations are more committed to their own survival than the common good. All the progress that's been made over the years, and it's significant in terms of decency, kindness, shared goals, the ability to disagree with other people respectfully, economic justice, racial reconciliation and civil rights, hospitality for people different than we are, respect for other religions, all this good stuff you could add to that list. All this forward movement seems now to be headed in the wrong direction, and so we've all become cynical, and we protect ourselves by refusing to hope and by expecting the worst. I think Isaiah's image of the tree is a wonderful gift to people like us in times like this. It's an image that looks forward and looks back at the same time. The green shoots emerging from the tree signal God's good plans for us and for the whole world. The roots that descend down into the earth picture for us our connectedness to a long tradition of God's faithfulness to people in difficult situations. The season of Advent is our time to remember that God is always, always at work doing something new and fresh right in our midst. But this new work is never disconnected from God's way of being faithful to those who came before us. Isaiah's image of the tree, named not directly for David, but for David's father, Jesse, right? This immediately calls to mind family trees, ancestry, genealogies. That's how Matthew's and Luke's Christmas story start, the birth narrative with genealogies, connections and roots. When the angels came to announce to young Mary that she would be the one to give birth to Israel's long-awaited Messiah, they spoke to Mary of lineage and ancestry. The Lord will give him the throne of King David, they announced. What connects us to God's faithfulness in the past and guides us all into the future is this image of peace in Isaiah. Not a peace that includes some people but leaves other people out. Not a peace that happens here and there with chaos still at work over there. This is a peace that covers the whole earth. And a peace that looks like justice, and a peace that affords dignity to all people everywhere. God's Spirit will come and will rest on this shoot from the tree of Jesse. With righteousness, he will judge the needy, and with justice, he will make decisions for the poor of the earth, Isaiah 11:4. Already, Isaiah's wonderful image ties God's peace to economic justice and to the welfare and the well-being of those who are poor and those who struggle to get by. So you and I sit here today at the beginning of another Advent season with our roots deep in this tradition of people who wait and watch for the arrival of God's peace in a world of hatred, division, violence, injustice, conflict, anger. And while we desperately long for this peace to blossom and flourish, we worry that these desires and these dreams for peace are a little futile, a little puny, kind of anemic little things that can't withstand the real world. And of course, we might be tempted to disregard Isaiah's tidings of hope and peace because we hear them sitting here in this beautiful sanctuary, in a church on a Sunday morning. This is a sacred time and sacred space. We might be thinking, well, okay, it's nice and all, but these are old words. They come from a very, very different cultural context in the Middle East. The Bible really isn't the real world. And this vision of peace, after all, Seth talked, it is a little bit ridiculous and absurd and bizarre, right? It's kind of abstract and dreamy and seems unworkable. But before you give up on Isaiah's symbol of the tree from Jesse and the peace that blossoms from it, I hope that you will give it one more chance to speak to you a lively word, a fresh opening for us here at the beginning of Advent. First, notice how specifically Isaiah's image ties God's peace to the safety and well-being of children. Did you catch that? For Isaiah, peace on earth means that young children will no longer be harmed. This is perhaps the most arresting part of Isaiah's vision. I don't like snakes, so this is a big deal for me. The infant will play near the cobra's den, and the young child will put its hand in the viper's nest. There was a thing on Twitter this week about a woman in Burma who found a python in her toilet. Those things really freak me out. I worry about stuff like that. The image jars us from Isaiah, since picturing our little ones playing among snakes is a terrifying image. It imagines a scenario where someone innocent and vulnerable is in grave danger. But during Advent, we are signing up for a peace that protects the vulnerable from harm. And of course, it includes small children everywhere, but it's not just small children. It includes anyone who needs protection. And it's a hope for a world where people are no longer devoured by one another, a world where the little ones are no longer preyed on by the rich and the powerful. And like Seth was talking about, the vision of peace in Isaiah even extends to our animal friends and to the earth itself. All will be well. Second, I want you to notice that Isaiah's image names a peace that is sturdy and durable enough for the actual world we inhabit. Now, it's not included in our readings, but I do want you to hear the last verse from Isaiah 11. It reads like this: "There will be a highway back home for those taken captive into Assyria, just like God made a highway for Israel when they came out of Egypt." It's a beautiful image. God creating highways for people who get themselves in difficult places in life. Assyria and Egypt were two violent, terrifying empires surrounding Israel. And Isaiah's vision of the tree with deep roots and branches that reach toward peace don't emerge while Isaiah is relaxing on the beach somewhere over spring break. He writes when all hell was breaking loose. Israel had escaped a brutal experience of slavery in Egypt, and now new powers like Assyria and Babylon were poised on their doorstep to invade, to conquer, and to enslave them yet again, and that is what happened. So Isaiah's vision of peace is not a recipe for how you can relax when all is well. It's a vision for people living in a time of violent world powers and for a time when terrifying threats are at your door. The good news is that you have roots in a people who have learned to hope in tough times. Advent is no time for cheap sentimentality about the cute baby Jesus. It's a time to link arms and to make plans together to resist King Herod, who slaughters all the children in Bethlehem. It's a time for resistance to all threats to human dignity and human flourishing. It's time to band together and fight for peace. Here's the final thing I want you to notice. Notice that Isaiah's image has always been received by people who were willing to become peacemakers. And I want to turn now to the gospel reading, which includes this beautiful prayer from Zechariah, father of John the Baptist. When he learns that his own child will become prophet of the coming Messiah, he prays, "By the tender mercy of our God, the dawn from on high will break upon us to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death," and get this, "to guide our feet into the way of peace." That's his prayer. Zechariah's prayer can become our prayer for this Advent season. Lord, guide our feet into the way of peace. It's not a prayer from the helpless to be rescued, notice. It's not a prayer from the passive for some magic God to come and make everything okay. It's a prayer for people who are willing to move their feet. It's a prayer by people willing to become peacemakers during difficult times. And I find great encouragement and inspiration from being part of this enormous rooted tree. Yes, it's a struggle to welcome God's peace into our lives, because welcoming that peace means that we're signing up to do some work, to become peacemakers in a world of conflict, social justice activists in a world that's rigged to favor the rich, truth tellers in a world full of illusions and lies. That's hard work. But friends, that's what you're signing up for during Advent, to become peacemakers. But I also find great comfort in being part of this enormous rooted tree. It means that what I face has been faced before. It means that we have important connections to other people a long way back behind us and a long way out in front of us. It's not that our lives are unimportant, but perhaps we would do well to be a little less melodramatic about the peculiarity of our own times and the uniqueness of our own situations. This tree that we're a part of houses many generations of people who have been born and struggled and fought and failed and laughed and danced and feasted, grew tired, grew sick, and died. And they kept hope alive, and we can too, friends. So during this Advent season, I invite you to welcome Isaiah's symbol of the tree of Jesse into your imagination, to take it into your heart, to let it become a companion for you this season, even perhaps a new way of seeing yourself. You are a person with deep roots and with hope for the future. You're part of a people who has deep roots and hope for the future. Though we live our lives, and we have to, on the surface, our roots reach down deep through the soil and into the earth of God's goodness. These roots tangle and interweave down deep beneath the surface, anchoring us, stabilizing us, nourishing us. So this is what we pray. Lord, during this Advent season, guide our feet into the way of peace. Amen.